Throughout Russia's years-long invasion of Ukraine, a central justification made by the Russian side in the war for having invaded Ukraine in the first place has been the expansion of the NATO military alliance right up towards Russia's borders over the years since the end of the Cold War. The Kremlin currently insists that in 1990, just before the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, NATO and Western officials allegedly made assurances to Moscow that NATO would never expand a single inch forward to the east in the new world that was emerging in Europe. But over the years that followed, the Kremlin argues that NATO then betrayed Russia and went back on their word by admitting Poland, Czechia, and Hungary into the alliance in 1999, followed by Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Slovakia, Romania, and Bulgaria in 2004, and their subsequent guarantees towards both Georgia and Ukraine towards future membership in the alliance that was extended in 2008, which, in the Kremlin's argument, finally crossed Russia's red lines and supposedly forced them into acting militarily in order to avoid becoming encircled by NATO. This argument made by the Kremlin that the West supposedly betrayed them and broke their promises made in the early 1990s has become the foundation for Russia's justification behind their brutal ongoing invasion of Ukraine. And the Russian government uses that argument to shift the blame for the unimaginable horrors that they're inflicting upon Ukraine onto the Western world instead. And in this video, I want to take the time to explain why NATO actually enlarged towards Russia's borders in the aftermath of the Cold War, why Russia's current arguments blaming the war on NATO's expansion don't hold as much water as you might think, and I want to explain all of this primarily from the perspective of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe themselves, who each decided to join NATO voluntarily of their own accord for their own strategic reasons in the later 1990s and the early 2000s. Back in November of 1989, the Berlin Wall had just collapsed in Germany, and the prospect of Germany reunifying again between East and West for the first time in 45 years had suddenly become a real and unexpected geopolitical possibility. In the weeks and months that followed, intense negotiations began between the United States, the Soviet Union, the European states, and the two Germanies on what German reunification might end up looking like. There were, in theory, only two practical possibilities that could be foreseen at the time. East Germany would either be absorbed into West Germany and, by extension, East Germany's territory would be subsumed into the NATO alliance that West Germany was already a part of. Or, East Germany would be absorbed into West Germany and the new unified Germany would become a neutral state neither in NATO nor in the Warsaw Pact in the center of Europe. The neutral option, however, was sharply rejected by European states like France and the UK, who feared what a united and powerful Germany outside of NATO in the core of Europe would mean for the future, in light of Germany's militant past. They argued at the time that in order to keep Germany democratic and invested in European unity and stability, all of Germany needed to be fully incorporated into European institutions like NATO, and could not be left neutral on their own. And so, the US ultimately agreed with that viewpoint and pressed on with negotiations with the Soviets to accept NATO enlargement to encompass East Germany's territory after the reunification process was completed. Only 3 months after the Berlin Wall had collapsed in February of 1990, then US Secretary of State James A. Baker and his West German counterpart, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, met with the Soviet Union's leader Mikhail Gorbachev to discuss what the status of a reunified Germany would look like in the future. During that meeting, archival evidence suggests that Baker offered a verbal assurance to Gorbachev that in the event of the United States maintaining its military presence in a future unified Germany within the framework of NATO, there would be no extension of NATO's jurisdiction or military presence by a single inch in the eastern direction, end quote. To some, this statement could be interpreted as Baker promising that NATO would not expand eastwards from West Germany to encompass the territory of East Germany, or potentially any further east into Europe as well. And a few months later, in May of 1990, the then Secretary General of NATO, Manfred Wörner, echoed similar assurances regarding eastward NATO enlargement verbally during a speech in Brussels. Similar verbal assurances were made by other high-ranking US and Western officials to Soviet leaders during this early period of negotiations. But at around the same time, the US National Security Council also suggested that the idea of keeping the former East Germany out of NATO within the context of a unified Germany was going to be an unworkable idea in practice. And so they quickly clarified that Baker's comments only meant that NATO troops themselves wouldn't be deployed any further east into the former East Germany from their current positions in West Germany after reunification, while territorially, East Germany would be fully within the legal coverage of the alliance. none of these verbal assurances were ever formally written down on paper into a treaty, and as the negotiations continued to evolve and moved on through the rest of the year in 1990, those early verbal assurances and ideas were steadily dropped with time. Months later, in September of 1990, the negotiations finally culminated with a treaty and the final settlement with respect to Germany, which the Soviet Union signed and which recognized that Eastern Germany would be fully incorporated into West Germany, including its membership in NATO. While NATO agreed that they wouldn't construct any permanent military bases in the former East Germany or station any nuclear weapons there. Nothing in that treaty was ever mentioned about the prospect of NATO membership being expanded anywhere else in Europe, or what that might even look like. Largely because at the time it was signed in September of 1990, the idea of NATO membership expanding to any other country further east than Germany was rather inconceivable, because they were all still members of the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact, and many of them still had tens of thousands of Soviet troops deployed to their territories, like Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary. Nobody at that time on either side of the negotiations could have known that within just over a year's time in the future, the Warsaw Pact would dissolve and then the Soviet Union itself would catastrophically collapse. And so, at the time in 1990, no written guarantees were ever made on the potential enlargement of NATO into any of these other states. And it's questionable if any serious discussions about that possibility were even made through 1990. So, in October of 1990, Germany reunified. NATO was extended to cover the former East Germany's territory, but without the presence of any NATO troops deployed there, and the Soviet Union's internal collapse began rapidly accelerating in often violent fashion. All three of the Baltic states had unilaterally declared their independence from the Soviet Union in 1990, but they initially went largely unrecognized, and even Mikhail Gorbachev was unwilling to accept their loss. Soviet troops were deployed into Lithuania in January of 1991 to try and restore the Kremlin's authority there, which led to a violent confrontation that saw 14 Lithuanian civilians killed by the Soviet soldiers and more than 700 others injured before the Soviets decided to withdraw. While around the same time, Soviet troops in neighboring Latvia attacked the Latvian Ministry of the Interior in the capital of Riga, that also ultimately resulted in the tragic deaths of 6 Latvians as well. All of which turbocharged the support of the Baltic states for their independence from Moscow even further. The Warsaw Pact alliance was finally dissolved between February and July of 1991, and the tens of thousands of Soviet soldiers deployed in Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary began their process of withdrawal, which in the case of Poland was not completed for 2 more years until 1993. By early August of 1991, with the Warsaw Pact dissolved and Germany reunified, the Soviet republics of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Moldova, Georgia, and Armenia had all already declared their independence, while Gorbachev attempted to salvage what was left of the Soviet Union with a new treaty that would have converted the country into a less centralized federal system. All of the remaining 9 Soviet republics who had not already declared their independence approved of the new treaty except for Ukraine, who was very hesitant about it, and then a group of Communist Party hardliners launched a coup d'etat the day before the treaty was supposed to be signed in order to prevent it from going into force and to restore the Kremlin's authority over all of the republics. The coup collapsed after only 2 days, but it was still enough to convince Ukraine that Moscow couldn't be trusted, and so Ukraine declared its own independence just a couple of days later after the coup had ended. And with that, the Soviet Union was effectively doomed and the entire country would be dissolved altogether within only a few more months by December of 1991. At this moment, at the very end of 1991, the Russian Empire, in both its Tsarist and Communist varieties, had collapsed twice during the 20th century, and all of the nervous, freshly independent states of Central and Eastern Europe at the end of 1991 looked back to the precedent of what had happened historically the last time the Tsarist version of the Russian Empire had collapsed in 1917. When that happened, for a brief moment in time, the chaos of the empire's collapse also resulted in a brief window of opportunity for the smaller nations, who had been occupied by the Russians for centuries, to secure their independence before the Russians could regain their strength again and take them back. Within a year of the imperial collapse by 1918, Russia was enveloped within a civil war. While Poland, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and the Muslim region of the North Caucasus, including Chechnya, had all declared their independence from Russia. But after the Bolsheviks began emerging victorious in the Russian Civil War, the Soviet Russians invaded and reconquered Chechnya, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Ukraine, and Belarus all by 1922, when they proclaimed the creation of the Soviet Union. But they had also attempted to conquer the Baltic states and Poland during this early period as well. By August of 1920, the Soviet Russians had invaded and successfully occupied about half of Poland and were at the gates of Warsaw itself, with victory appearing imminent. But then, they were unexpectedly and decisively defeated by the Poles at Warsaw. The whole tide of the war changed after that, and the Poles managed to push the Russians further back until a peace treaty was signed between them in 1921 that established Poland's interwar borders and which also secured Poland's independence from Russia for the first time in the past 126 years since the Polish state was extinguished by the Russians all the way back in 1795. And in their fight for independence against the Russians between 1919 and 1921, around 50,000 Poles paid for it with their lives. And unfortunately for Poland, it would only be the first war they would fight against Russia for their independence during the 20th century, and they would ultimately lose the Second War. Only 18 years after Poland and the Soviet Union ended their first war, the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany agreed on the infamous Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in August of 1939, that divided Eastern Europe between their own spheres of influence. Within weeks of the pact being signed, Germany invaded Poland from the west, and shortly after, the Soviet Union invaded Poland once again from the east. The Soviets then annexed the eastern territories of Poland they conquered into the Soviet republics of Belarus and Ukraine, which remain to this day. A few months later, in November of 1939, the Soviets launched another all-out invasion into Finland, with the initial goal of conquering the entire country and absorbing it back into the red version of the Russian Empire. But after they suffered enormous casualties in Finland and failed to make significant advances, they settled with forcing Finland into ceding about 10% of their territory over to Russia instead, which also remains Russian to this day, and nearly 26,000 Finns were killed during the invasion. And then, a few months after their invasions of Finland and Poland, the Soviets invaded and conquered all three of the Baltic states over the summer of 1940, and forcefully annexed them directly as constituent republics into the Soviet Union. And they also threatened Romania with a further invasion unless they agreed to surrender over the territory of Bessarabia, which the Romanians only agreed to do under the immense threat of war if they did not, which then essentially became the Soviet Republic of Moldova. All of these Soviet invasions between 1939 and 1940 were launched into former territories of the Tsarist Russian Empire who had achieved and secured their independence over the previous 22 years since the collapse of 1917. Then, after Nazi Germany betrayed the Soviet Union and invaded them in 1941, the Soviets eventually managed to defeat them and push them all the way back to Berlin by 1945. And in the process, the Soviet Red Army found its troops in control over most of Eastern Europe. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the Soviet Union re-annexed Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania against their wills, annexed the former German territory of Königsberg that they renamed to Kaliningrad, and forcefully imposed puppet communist regimes loyal to the Kremlin in the states their army came to occupy, from Bulgaria to Romania to Hungary to Czechoslovakia to Poland and to East Germany, which eventually became the members of the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact. And when some of these states attempted to resist their occupation by the Soviet-Russian Empire, they were met with extreme violence. In 1956, when the Hungarians rose up in a mass revolution against their Soviet-installed puppet government, the Soviet army that was deployed to Hungary responded with an overwhelming crackdown that killed as many as 3,000 Hungarians and resulted in almost 250,000 Hungarians fleeing the country as exiles. Then, a little more than a decade later, in 1968, when the government of Czechoslovakia attempted to liberalize and moderate its harsh Soviet-imposed communist regime, the Soviet Union led the Warsaw Pact into an all-out massive invasion of the country, with 500,000 soldiers to crush the reforms, that killed 137 people in the country and seriously injured another 500 or so others. All of this historical context of how Russia reacted after the first collapse of its empire in 1917, with all of its subsequent attempts to forcibly reconquer the territories it felt it had lost, heavily influenced the deep suspicions of the states of Central and Eastern Europe who emerged independent again after the second collapse in 1991. They almost all universally feared that, given enough time, Russia would one day regain its strength, its power, and its confidence, and come for them again, just like they did after the first collapse in 1917. especially in light of the fact that the Russian armed forces didn't even complete their withdrawal from Poland until 1993, and they didn't complete their withdrawal from the Baltic states until 1994. Many of them quickly came to see that their biggest guarantee of security from a revisionist Russia in the future that they didn't have between 1917 and 1940 would be by acquiring their membership in NATO, and through it, the extremely valuable Article 5 security guarantee that asserts that an armed attack on one NATO member state is an armed attack against all of them, including the post-Cold War sole remaining global superpower, the United States. And then, Russia almost immediately started doing things in the 1990s that appeared to confirm the suspicions of the Central and Eastern Europeans that Russia was going to attempt and rebuild its lost empire again, just like they did after 1917. And that meant that they were all in a race against the clock to get themselves into NATO before Russia could get to them. Already as early as 1992, merely months after the Soviet Union collapsed, the newly independent Russia under President Boris Yeltsin intervened in Moldova militarily, a former Soviet republic, in order to support a pro-Russian secessionist movement there in the region of Transnistria. The Russians supported war in Transnistria against the Moldovan government in 1992 killed hundreds of people and resulted in about 12% of Moldova's internationally recognized territory coming effectively under Russian military occupation, where roughly 2,000 Russian soldiers have been permanently deployed to ever since, straight up into the present day. And Moldova was far from the only recently independent country that the Russians intervened in and helped to dismember in the 1990s. At around the same time that the Russian army intervened in Moldova in 1992, Tajikistan, another former Soviet republic, descended into a civil war that saw thousands of Russian soldiers enter into the conflict on the side of the pro-Russian Tajik government in order to crush the rebellion. By 1997, the pro-Russian government in Tajikistan had been stabilized by the Russian intervention, and anywhere between 20,000 and 150,000 people were killed in the country during the war, while as much as 20% of the entire population of Tajikistan had been internally displaced by the fighting. And then, there were also the events in Georgia of the early 1990s, too. In 1992, ethnic Ossetian separatist forces had revolted against the Georgian government in the territory of South Ossetia. And while fighting between them and the Georgian government was ongoing over the summer of 1992, the chairman of the Russian parliament at the time, Ruslan Khasbulatov, publicly accused the Georgians of allegedly committing genocide against the Ossetians and threatened that Russia would forcibly annex South Ossetia unless Georgia immediately agreed to a ceasefire that allowed Russian peacekeepers to enter into the territory. Russia mobilized troops along the border, and armed skirmishes between the Russian and Georgian armies were reported as the countries appeared to be on the brink of war, before Georgia finally caved into the pressure and agreed on a ceasefire that left most of South Ossetia under the de facto control of the separatists. And if that wasn't enough, Russia decided to intervene in another rebellion in Georgia in the region of Abkhazia, too. In August of 1992, just a couple months after the ceasefire in South Ossetia was made, another ethnic conflict broke out in the Georgian region of Abkhazia between the ethnic Abkhaz minority and the ethnic Georgian majority there. The war in Abkhazia turned into a particularly brutal affair that saw the deaths of tens of thousands of people. And although Russia took an officially neutral position on the war, in practice, it came to much more heavily support the Abkhaz side in the war after the Georgians shot down a couple Russian military helicopters. In early 1993, using unmarked aircraft in order to maintain plausible deniability, the Russian Air Force bombed the Georgian-held city of Sukhumi in Abkhazia, while hundreds of unmarked regular Russian troops were covertly deployed to the territory to fight alongside of the Abkhazians. And they even directly engaged the Georgian armed forces in a battle near the village of Tamishi that resulted in hundreds of killed and wounded on both sides. The covert Russian intervention on the side of the Abkhaz separatists in early 1993 decisively shifted the course of the war, and in their victory, the Russian-backed Abkhaz separatists engaged in a wide-scale campaign of reprisals, massacres, and ethnic cleansing of the territory's remaining Georgian population. More than 5,000 Georgian civilians were massacred by the Abkhaz forces, and around 250,000 Georgians were forcibly expelled out of Abkhazia into the rest of Georgia, which was later formally recognized as an act of ethnic cleansing by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Within only 2 years of the Soviet Union collapsing, post-Soviet Russia directly intervened in four wars in the post-Soviet world, and helped to dismember the freshly independent states of Moldova and Georgia, which obviously alarmed the other freshly independent post-Soviet and post-Warsaw Pact states. And then, alarming them even further, the president of Russia at the time in 1993, Boris Yeltsin, launched a violent self-coup in order to keep himself in power and to expand the powers of the Russian presidency even further. In September of 1993, the Russian parliament voted to impeach Yeltsin and proclaimed his vice president to be the new acting president. And then they all barricaded themselves within the Russian White House in Moscow. Yeltsin, however, refused to stand down. And for the next several days, intense fighting in the streets of Moscow took place between the supporters of Yeltsin and the supporters of the parliament, while the Russian army remained neutral at first. But on the 4th of October in 1993, the Russian army finally decided to side with Yeltsin, and then, on his direct orders, Russian tanks bombarded the White House where the parliament was still barricaded inside, before the building was stormed by special forces units who arrested all of the parliament's leaders. The whole incident represented the deadliest single event of street fighting in the history of Moscow since the October Revolution. A total of 147 people were killed, and hundreds of others were wounded in the violence. While Yeltsin's use of the army to crush the parliament who had voted to impeach him enabled him to greatly consolidate power and to strengthen the office of the presidency. It was this moment that especially alarmed the freshly independent states of Central and Eastern Europe, because, in a sense, it symbolized the early death of any hope of democracy taking off in post-Soviet Russia, and it laid the foundations for the long legacy of autocracy to return back to Russia again following the Soviet and the Tsarist periods. And it would not be long after that before Russia would undertake the first all-out reconquest of a lost piece of their empire in Chechnya. During the collapse of the Soviet Union, the 15 separate republics that made up the Soviet Union all declared their independence from the Soviet Union. But several territories within many of those republics also tried to declare their independence from the republics. One of the most notable examples of this was Chechnya in the North Caucasus, which was administratively an autonomous republic within the Russian Soviet Republic during the Soviet era. But Chechnya was, and is, very demographically distinct from the rest of Russia. In 1991, as the Soviet Union was collapsing, 96% of Chechnya's population were ethnic Chechens who were overwhelmingly Muslims, while only 1.6% of the territory's population were ethnic Russians. There was also still a significant degree of resentment among the Chechen population over the mass deportation of the entire Chechen population to Central Asia that had been ordered by Stalin during the Second World War, in which around 500,000 Chechens were forcibly deported and as many as 200,000 of them died, or about one-third of their total population. In 2004, the European Parliament would classify the event as an act of genocide perpetrated by the Soviet state against the Chechens, and the Chechen survivors were not allowed to return back to their native homeland until 1957, which steadily led to the Chechens demographically recovering and becoming a majority of the population in Chechnya again by 1991. With this history of resentment and mistrust in mind, Chechnya unilaterally declared its independence from Russia in November of 1991, just a month before the Soviet Union was formally dissolved. 3 years of instability within Chechnya followed as various warlords and factions rose up and began fighting one another. While Russia made several limited but unsuccessful attempts to re-establish its control, Chechnya remained a de facto independent state, but went unrecognized as such by any country in the world other than the Taliban-ruled Afghanistan. By the end of November in 1994, a bit over a year after Yeltsin attacked the Russian parliament and consolidated power, Yeltsin delivered an ultimatum to the Chechen government that demanded everyone in the territory lay down their arms and surrender to Russia or else. The Chechens chose or else, and Yeltsin ordered the Russian armed forces to launch a full-scale invasion. The Russians initially thought that the invasion of Chechnya would be a swift victory, but instead, it turned into a brutal quagmire as the Chechens resisted far more heavily than initially expected. Thousands of Russian soldiers were killed, and frustrated, the Russians shifted their tactics to just obliterating Chechnya cities and villages block by block, with overwhelming artillery fire and airstrikes to crush the territory's resistance, with little regard for civilian casualties. This strategy is estimated to have killed around 27,000 Chechen civilians in the capital city of Grozny within just the first 5 weeks after they started, which represented the deaths of roughly 6% of Grozny's pre-war population. Then, in April of 1995, a group of Russian soldiers entered into the Chechen village of Semashki, where, reportedly drunk and high on drugs, they proceeded to massacre as many as 300 of the village's civilian inhabitants, which was condemned by international humanitarian aid agencies from around the world at the time. The Russians also utilized filtration camps in Chechnya, where they detained around 200,000 Chechens throughout the course of the war, adding to the indiscriminate methods that the Russian military dished out to the territory's civilians. By the summer of 1996, Chechnya was absolutely devastated by the invasion. It's been since estimated by several different sources that around 100,000 Chechen civilians were killed in the conflict, largely by Russia's indiscriminate bombardments of Chechen cities and villages, representing around 10% of Chechnya's entire pre-invasion population being killed, while 500,000 more Chechens had been displaced, and tens of thousands of Russian soldiers have been killed or wounded as well. In their attempt to crush Chechnya and reincorporate it back into Russia, Russia undertook the heaviest and largest-scale bombing campaign seen in Europe since the end of the Second World War, and they arguably partook in another genocide of the Chechen people as well. By 1996, the ruins of Chechnya's capital city, Grozny, looked like colored photographs of Berlin or Dresden or other cities ruined by World War II. The two sides eventually agreed on a ceasefire in 1996 that left Chechnya de facto independent, but completely ruined and crippled. And only a few years later, in 1999, under a new president, Russia would eventually return and finish the job it started in Chechnya. The First Chechen War, as it would later come to be called, was an early and horrifying precursor to the actions that Russia would later take in Syria and ultimately in Ukraine. And as Russia's annihilation of Chechnya was ongoing between 1994 and 1996, the other freshly independent nations of Central and Eastern Europe, who Russia had also used to dominate, grew even more nervous that the fate of Chechnya could in time become their own fates as well if they failed to protect themselves and deter Russia from ever trying. And they all steadily came to see that getting accepted into the NATO alliance and acquiring protection through NATO's mutual defense clause was going to be all of their best methods for doing that. At the time, however, there was a substantial amount of debate within NATO and within the United States on the wisdom of extending NATO membership any deeper into Europe. There were some Western foreign policy experts in the 1990s who argued that NATO enlargement was unnecessary, and that it would be unwise to extend America's ironclad security guarantees eastward into Europe to nations who were not seen as core strategic interests of Washington. And of course, there was also the fear in the West that enlarging NATO further through Europe across former Warsaw Pact and Soviet states would enrage Russia, and could potentially lead to the Russians fighting in order to prevent it. But in light of Russia's massive invasion and obliteration of Chechnya, its interventions into Georgia and Moldova, and the horrific wars that were also going on in the former Yugoslavia at the time in Croatia and Bosnia that had collectively resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in Europe, NATO conducted a study in 1995 on the merits of further enlarging the alliance during this era of instability, and it essentially concluded that European security, stability, and democracy could all be strengthened by extending NATO membership to more countries on the continent. A couple years later, by 1997, NATO would formally extend an invitation to join the alliance to the first three countries of Central and Eastern Europe: Poland, Czechia, and Hungary. But these three nations didn't simply join the alliance just because they asked to join it. Poland, in particular, with its long history of being invaded and occupied by Russia, and watching on nervously at the events that were unfolding in Chechnya, Moldova, and Georgia, and knowing about the internal debates going on within NATO concerning the wisdom of expanding, was so eager to join NATO and to secure its mutual defense protection that Poland effectively blackmailed its way into NATO instead. Polish government officials, as early as 1995, began implying to the Clinton administration that if Poland were not invited to join NATO, Poland would seek out its security through alternative means, like by acquiring their own independent nuclear weapons arsenal instead. And then, to add on even more pressure, during the 1996 US presidential election season, the former president of Poland and the country's first democratically elected leader following the end of communism, Lech Walesa, personally visited Washington, D.C. and started meeting with Clinton's political opposition, the Republicans. At the time, the Republicans were more heavily backing the support of the NATO Enlargement Facilitation Act in Congress against Clinton, which called for America's direct support in getting the new democracies of Central and Eastern Europe into NATO as quickly as possible. At the time, Lech Walesa was widely viewed as a Polish hero who led Poland out of its occupation by the Soviet Union, and so his influence among the Polish-American community in the United States was considered substantial. This was important, because Polish Americans made up very large percentages of the population in critical electoral swing states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And so even the implied threat of Lech Walesa campaigning for the Republicans in these swing states was enough to add even further pressure on the Clinton administration to begin lending its support for Poland's entry into NATO. All of this finally culminated in the U.S. Congress and Clinton passing the NATO Enlargement Facilitation Act in 1996, NATO formally extending an invitation to join the alliance to Poland, Czechia, and Hungary in 1997, and their formal entries into the alliance 2 years later at the end of the decade in 1999. They joined NATO only 31 years after the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact had invaded Czechoslovakia, and they marked the first of the former Warsaw Pact states to be admitted into NATO since East Germany unified with West Germany. They also joined NATO in the same year that Vladimir Putin first became Russia's prime minister, theoretically second in power in the country only behind the president, which was still nominally held at the time by Boris Yeltsin. And almost immediately as Putin rose to power as the country's prime minister, he led the Russian armed forces into a second all-out invasion of Chechnya that was much more successful than their first attempt. The Chechen capital, Grozny, already devastated from the fighting of the first invasion attempt that had ended only 3 years previously, was subjected to 2 months straight of overwhelming aerial and artillery bombardment that almost completely leveled what little of it remained, before 100,000 Russian ground troops stormed into the territory to secure the ruins and mop up resistance. Once again, tens of thousands of people in Chechnya were killed, while Grozny itself was so badly damaged in the process that the United Nations labeled it in 2003 as the most heavily destroyed city on the planet. But in the aftermath, Chechnya was fully reconquered by the Russian army and reabsorbed back into Russia. The Russians installed an almost totalitarian puppet regime into power to govern the territory that remains in charge there today, and Putin's popularity in Russia skyrocketed, enabling him to consolidate power next and to secure the country's presidency by 2000. And it was shortly after that, in 2004, when NATO would add its next 7 countries in Central and Eastern Europe, all of whom had their separate historical, geographic, and political reasons to fear an attack from Russia or another aggressor in Europe in the future. Slovenia had just been invaded by the Serb-led Yugoslav army as recently as 1991. Slovakia, like Czechia, had been invaded by the Soviet army as recently as 1968, while occupying Soviet troops hadn't left their country until 1991. Romania and Bulgaria each had dictatorial communist regimes imposed upon them, while Romania had territory taken from them by the Soviets during the Second World War. And then, of course, the 3 Baltic states had all been invaded and directly conquered by the Soviets and were subjected to decades worth of population transfers and Russification policies that had left behind more than 800,000 ethnic Russians across their countries following the Soviet collapse, whose supposed protection they feared Russia might one day use as a pretext for another invasion and conquest in the future. NATO didn't move east in the post-Cold War era so much as the freshly independent states of Central and Eastern Europe quickly moved west, and to prove it, NATO never deployed any foreign permanent military bases to any of those Eastern and Central European states who joined the alliance until after Russia invaded Ukraine and seized Crimea in 2014. And by now, almost a couple decades later after they joined in 2004, following Russia's full-scale invasion of Georgia in 2008, its massive military intervention in Syria, and their massive invasions of Ukraine since 2014 that have killed hundreds of thousands of people, do you think any of them regret their decision to have done so and joined NATO? In Ukraine in particular, Russia's ongoing all-out invasion of the country since 2022 has resulted in by far the deadliest conflict in Europe since the Second World War, that has even exceeded the devastation that the Russian armed forces wrought upon Chechnya during the 1990s. Its invasion encouraged Finland and Sweden to apply to and join NATO next. And over nearly 3 years of war, the conflict has likely caused more than 1 million human casualties, making it among the deadliest conflicts anywhere in the entire 21st century. Over the past year in particular, the Russian armed forces have made bloody but consistent gains across the east of Ukraine, to the point where the Russian armed forces have conquered roughly 2,700 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory since the start of 2024, representing a total area roughly the size of Luxembourg, and which also represents roughly 6 times as much territory they have conquered from Ukraine as they did in the previous year across 2023. 2024 was a very, very difficult year for Ukraine, and as their casualties mount, they're steadily losing more ground, while countries on the other side of Ukraine and NATO, especially Poland, are growing more and more anxious and nervous about what is going to happen in the future. And the current higher pace of Russia's territorial gains in Ukraine through 2024 began with Russia's capture of the city of Avdiivka in February, that followed an enormous battle for the city's control. Just as the Russians did at Grozny in the 1990s, the Russian armed forces first tried to simply storm into Avdiivka and take it. And after that failed with catastrophic casualties, they resorted to effectively obliterating Avdiivka with overwhelming artillery fire and airstrikes, before they slowly encircled it and advanced forward to mop up the remaining resistance. The Ukrainians had transformed Avdiivka into a veritable urban fortress, and the ferocious battle for the city's control between October of 2023 and February of 2024 not only left the city itself in ruins, but it represented some of the fiercest urban street fighting seen in Europe since the Second World War, and it resulted in more Russian casualties alone than during the entire Soviet invasion of Afghanistan throughout all of the 1980s. And though it was costly for Russia, their capture of Avdiivka ultimately opened up the path for their forces to continue advancing through the rest of the year, further westwards across the Donetsk province towards the next strategically important city, Pokrovsk, where Russian forces are currently beginning to approach. But unfortunately, due to the inherently violent, controversial, and recent nature of discussing one of the biggest battles fought in modern Europe that claimed the lives of tens of thousands of real human beings on both of the sides who were condemned to fighting it, the next part of this video that would cover it would almost certainly cause the rest of the video before it to become demonetized and age-restricted, which ultimately would mean that YouTube's algorithm would have never promoted any of this video to you, and you probably never would have seen any of it. But thankfully, I was still able to produce the next part of this video anyway because of the power of Nebula, where you can go and watch the next part covering how the battle for Avdiivka went, and what its implications have been for the Ukrainian battlefield specifically, and for European security more broadly. And this is also just one of more than several dozen exclusive full-length real-life lore videos that you can only find on Nebula in my overall modern conflict series there, which can all only be found over there because of all of their darker, more controversial subject material. That means that there's a bunch of other previous episodes you can also go and watch right now that were very relevant to this video, like this episode going into depth on the wars in Chechnya during the 1990s, this episode covering Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2008, this episode covering Russia's intervention in Moldova in 1992, this episode covering Russia's intervention in the Syrian Civil War, or all of these episodes covering the whole course of Russia's ongoing invasion of Ukraine, and all of the backstory that led up to it, with brand new episodes releasing over there every single month. And even better, I also recently started another completely new monthly series on Nebula called War Room, which will track all of the latest breaking geopolitical news developing from conflicts from all around the world and break them down into a single, easily digestible monthly video briefing series that'll help you stay even more up to date and informed on what's currently happening around the world and why. The latest episode in War Room covering all of the breaking geopolitical news and developments from last month in November, including the recent developments in Syria, is live on Nebula for you to also go and watch right now. And what's even more, you also get access to all of the other amazing exclusive content that's on Nebula, because the best part about this site is that it's jointly co-owned by all of its creators, built by myself and hundreds of other independent YouTubers and podcasters. And because it's a subscription-based service, we all get to work on way bigger and higher budget productions over there than we could ever afford to do on YouTube. That's why there's tons of other exclusive content that you'll find equally fascinating from all of these other creators over there you probably also already know as well. And best of all, if you sign up by clicking the button that's here on your screen right now or by following the link that's down below in the description, you'll receive an insane 40% discount off of an annual subscription, which means it'll only cost you $3 a month or $36 a year for all of this awesome exclusive content from myself and hundreds of other independent creators, with even more stuff getting added every single month. And if you already have a Nebula subscription and you want to gift one to a friend or a loved one, you can also now do that as well with a gifted subscription, with the same discount applied by following the link down below in the description as well. It's the absolute best way to help support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore, and as always, thank you so much for watching.